Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Harmonize with me and hold me tight all through the night. You're shining bright. I'm your oyster, baby. You're my pearl.
Tom!
William.
Here we are!
Here we are indeed.
Are you comfortable?
Financially.
No, just like where your butt is.
Yeah, these chairs are quite comfy, actually. I would like to be a little bit more, you know, skewed towards you.
Yeah, we should probably, at some point, do that. Because why are we, like, I feel like, that, you know, like avant-garde theatre, where the people don't talk to each other, they talk out to the audience, you know, when they're talking to each other. That's what we're like an avant-garde podcast.
I've always felt that we were that anyway.
We're always on the edge, aren't we?
I feel a little bit like I'm on a comfy throne.
Yeah, me too. But we should ask somebody why in a podcast where it's about conversation we don't actually look at each other.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe we could ask this guy.
What guy?
This little guy here.
Yeah, you could ask him. You might not get much out of him.
Doesn't look like he knows too much, to be honest.
Peeling the onion.
We've had some questions. Should we jump into these?
Let me just get comfortable. This is another thing I think about this seat, Tom. I like to be on one side or the other. I don't like being in the middle. I feel like it's too wide. So I like to be on one side.
You get kind of squished in one side.
Or the t'other. But anyway, let me get comfortable and then hit me with a question, Tom.
You get comfortable because this is actually a question for you.
Go on then.
From Elise in Washington, United States of America.
Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
Well, she didn't stipulate.
Well,
there's two of them, isn't there?
Yes, there is, Dom.
Hello, Elise. She said, Billy, yes, when you got the news that you had been cast in Rent, did you find out what character you were originally cast as? Who were you going for?
I did. It was... Johnny. No, I forget his name now. He's the filmmaker. There's a rock star.
Never seen it.
There's a filmmaker, and it's a filmmaker. How do you document real life when real life's getting more like a fiction each day? That's what he says.
So his life is getting more like a film, and he's trying to capture what real life feels like. You didn't get it, did you?
No, I didn't get
it. You were told that you got it.
I was told I got it.
You didn't get it.
I didn't get it. And I really wanted it.
Mm.
But it's the guy, the filmmaker... and I forget his name. That's terrible. Roger's the rock star. Angel is a lovely part. And then it's not Keith. It's like Keith.
People out there are screaming at you what it is. That's all right. What does he say his name in the song?
Maybe. Yeah, he does.
Does he?
I, Steve, wish that life was less like a film.
Something like that.
So, yeah, that was that guy anyway. Tom, do you want one? Do you want a question?
Yeah, go on.
Right. Hold on to your hat, Tom. Don't read the questions, otherwise you'll know what it is.
Well, I don't know the answer. Just the question.
Do you know the answer?
Do you know the answer?
Right, hold this. Hold on.
Hold this.
Hold
this. It's not that type of podcast.
Hey, Craig Deacon from Germany. From Landstuhl.
Oh, Landstuhl.
Landstuhl in
Germany. Lovely pronunciation there, Bill.
Do you know where that is?
No.
Right, we'll carry on then. Hey, fellas, he says. I'm reaching out from Landstuhl, Germany. I was watching Fellowship of the Ring. I was wondering if you could tell me more details on when the orcs and cave troll was attacking in the Mines of Moria, for example, you all attacked the cave troll after Frodo got stabbed by the troll and you jumped on him. What was used for that scene? What did you jump on? Because there wasn't a troll there, he's saying.
No, there wasn't.
Dom, if there is something you would like me to send you from Germany, let me know. I know you've spent some time there and were even born there. I put that bit in.
Oh, yeah, good, thanks.
Thanks, guys. And then he says, as a throwaway at the end, I love you, Billy, and the same goes to you. But he doesn't really mean that.
Mm.
He meant that more for you because you've got the kind of German heritage, as it were.
Cheers.
But I love Germany. You know that. It's one of my favourite countries.
Do you know that word? That's a good one to remember in Germany. What? I'm sure you've heard it before. Cheers.
Cheers.
It's a little bit like ciao.
Yeah, in other all parts the best. Of
cheers. See you later.
Cheers. It's das mein Stuhl.
Yeah. Cheers.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Good.
All right.
Sehr gut.
Well, the question.
Yeah.
We attacked a cave troll. What was used for the scene when we jumped on him? Well, do you want to say?
I want to hear you because I've got a feeling that your memory of this
is not right.
It's going to be foggy.
My recollection of it is that it's not actually us. It's a computer-generated version of us jumping onto a computer-generated troll. Or is that not correct?
That's not 100% correct.
Sorry about that.
Only one of us jumped on a troll, Dom.
Oh.
It was me.
Really? What did you jump on?
Pete
Jackson.
There was a few different things, but like when we were fighting the troll and hiding behind the thing and all, if you remember, sometimes it was just a tennis ball on a stick.
I remember that.
So just so that we were all looking at the right thing.
For his eyes, basically.
Yeah,
right.
But they did have, obviously, what it was going to look like, and Pete brought us in a computer and said, this is what the troll will be like and how he moves so that you know. And if I'm honest, the scene where I'm on his back, I can't 100% remember what I was on. But I remember I did have to do, I had to jump off it and do a forward roll.
Oh!
Which, yeah, that was quite exciting.
Yeah?
But I think it was just, there was a few different things. Sometimes I was actually on like a stunt man, and sometimes it was like, you know, just on a sort of thing that they built off the ground in wood. And looking at you, you were down trying to stab him and
oh,
all.
Oh, I was there. I was there for you, giving you an eye line because you didn't have one from the cave troll. And I was happy to do it. Well, you started off by saying, I think your memories about the cave troll are going to be vague, Dom. And your memories about the cave troll were quite vague, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been hoisted by your own petard there.
But I do remember doing it, and I remember it being quite an exciting thing, the whole cave troll thing and that.
Yeah, that sequence was great because all the fellowship were encased in Moria together, and we were there all day. There was a lovely feeling on set. There was a nice little fun dynamic teasing between the humans and the elves and the elves and the dwarves and the hobbits were in their own little thing, right?
Yeah.
Ian McKellen was in a good mood and he was winding up Vigo and Orlando and we were all having fun. It was a great feeling. I think we were all just a bit giddy and excited by just how incredible that set was because Moria was one of the best, wasn't it?
It was brilliant.
Incredible. Skulls everywhere.
I'm not going to get super into the Rings of Power right now, the TV show.
The TV show, yeah.
Because we might speak a little bit about that show today with our fantastic guest.
True.
But I will say, one of the things I like best about it is when there's characters that you're like, oh, that character was in Lord of the Rings somehow, like Durin. Like Moria. That was his tomb we were in. And then to see him on TV now, like, and seeing his story.
Yeah.
And I do think the actor that plays Durin is fantastic.
He's very good. And I love seeing Moria looking so healthy and, you know, it's a place where a great community is strong.
There's elevators going up.
Yeah, very cool.
Some very cool stuff in that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Craig. We've got one last question here from the lovely Sophie Harris.
Where's Sophie Harris from?
She didn't say where she was from.
She's just leaving it just as a question.
It's just from planet Earth. She said, hi, guys. Why do moths love light so much, like light bulbs and phone screens? And I'm interested to see what Billy thinks about this, if you were to answer it. Why are moths attracted to?
I've known you for a long time, Dom. And if I get this wrong, this would be very embarrassing.
Yeah,
I'm sure that a few people have asked you that over the years. Dom being an expert of moths and other flying creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And also creatures that crawl and walk on two and four legs.
Yeah, creatures in
six
general.
And eight.
Mm-hmm. Creatures in general. But a lot of flying nocturnal creatures are attracted to lights, aren't they?
Here's what I'm thinking,
Don. You tell me.
They think it's the moon.
Oh, good.
And they think, I'll fly towards that for a reason that is beyond me.
Mm.
But they do think it's the moon.
They do think it's the moon, yeah.
But why would they be flying towards the moon?
Yeah, well, so you've got half of it, right?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, those animals do navigate by the light of the moon, but obviously the moon is a long way away from them. So what they do is they keep the moon at a certain kind of angle gradient to where they fly, and they always keep it, let's say for the sake of argument, to their left at 45 degrees. So they know if they're going to turn right, then they face in the opposite direction from where they go.
Right, yeah.
But with an artificial light being so close, they think, well, I'll just fly in the direction of the thing. That's my kind of North Star. Yeah.
But and then I'll work it out.
But then they get caught in a little cyclone where they're trapped now with no direction because they've hit the thing that they're navigating by. Do you know what I mean?
Happened to me once playing Blind Man's Buff in my gran's hallway.
Mm.
You know Blind Man's Buff?
Basically, you're blindfolded and you're trying to catch other kids.
Yeah. So I get stuck in the corner, and the corner of a hallway only has two walls. And for some reason, Dom, I could not get out of there.
So you went left, right, couldn't work it out.
I couldn't work out
how. I bet all your pals were laughing at you, weren't they?
What do you think happened? I was like a moth at the light.
Moth to a flame. And obviously a lot of flying animals do that. Spiders are very smart because they tend to put up their webs close to artificial lights now so that they don't have to do all the work. The animals will come to them. Yeah, you'll see that a lot around.
That's amazing.
I mean, when you and I were in Thailand, any light that goes up, all the spiders and all the snakes and lizards will just hang out by that light waiting for food to come to them.
A spider's web has to be one of the most amazing things ever, eh?
Yeah, pretty incredible.
That there's an animal that makes its own trap out of its butt, is it?
Yeah, out of its abdomen, yeah. I mean, and can make different consistency in that web.
Right.
So it can make some that it uses for it to, like, shelter in its little, you know, hideaway.
Uh-huh.
And then some that it uses to trap animals. And then some that when the animal shows up, it produces a very sticky webbing so that it can trap it very quickly. So they can create different consistencies to that webbing.
Amazing.
Super incredible. Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. It can be tough to train your brain to stay in a problem-solving mode when faced with a challenging life. But when you learn how to find your own solutions, there's no better feeling. A therapist can help you become a better problem solver, making it easy to accomplish your goals, no matter how big or how small.
That's right, Dom. Sometimes you just need to speak to someone about your problems. It's otherwise, true. You keep them inside and you can spiral into that problem rather than thinking about, well, how am I going to fix this?
Yeah.
And it's great to talk to friends and family, but sometimes there's nothing better than speaking to a professional, and that's what BetterHelp does very, very well.
Absolutely. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable, and entirely online. You can get matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey and switch therapists anytime you like.
When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/onion today and get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/onion.
Remember the days before streaming services when you would just come home from high school and it was only a few hours until that TV show that everyone was watching was going to come on? Your friends were on their way over for a watch party and the smell of popcorn filled the room. Well, in 1999, that particular show was one of Billy's favourites, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Well, in the new podcast from Wondery, the rewatcher Buffy the Vampire Slayer, we are taking it back to 1999. Get out your knee-high boots and paste that poster of Angel on your wall. It's time to enter the Buffyverse. Join Morbid co-stars Ash and Elena as they slay their way through Buffy's drama, action and romance, episode by episode.
Mm-hmm. Enter the Buffyverse with Alana and Ash. Listen to the rewatcher Buffy the Vampire Slayer on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, or listen early and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.
buff me, baby, one more time.
William.
What is it, John?
Look to your left, there's Bear.
Hello.
Hello.
How's it going, Bear?
Great. How are you guys?
We are very happy that you've decided to come into the friendship onion.
I am thrilled. There's no other onion I would rather be at right
the
now.
The best onion.
That is the best onion.
It's the only onion that won't make you cry, hopefully, Bear.
And we're big fans for many reasons. A lot of the people that listen to the Friendship Onion will, of course, know you from the new Lord of the Rings on TV.
Oh, yes.
But of course, there is many, many things that you have done. And if you don't mind, we'd like to embarrass you by listing a few just now.
Hold on, let me prepare myself.
Just enjoy this.
I am ready.
Dominic, would you like to?
I can't read, you know.
Oh, well, I'll go ahead then. Bear. Are you ready? An American musician and composer of film, television, and video games, based in Los Angeles, California, included in his works. Get ready for this, people. Battlestar Galactica.
Classic.
What an absolute beauty we're starting
with.
So
say we all.
An absolute classic.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Mm. Oh, yes. Oh, Outlander.
Oh, I've heard.
Indeed.
Oh,
very close to my heart.
Yes.
The Walking Dead.
Fantastic.
The Rings of Power, of course. Mm. And video games, Call of Duty Vanguard, God of War. Mm. I mean, it just goes on and on. Godzilla.
Goes on.
I mean, you've got Emmys, blah, 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 blah. Demons, BAFTAs. I mean, we won't go through it, but geez.
You have embarrassed me enough. Yes, thank you.
That is absolutely plenty. Mm. But, going back to Battlestar Galactica, I think that's where I first got introduced to your work.
That's where everyone that saw it got introduced to my work. That was my first job.
Was it really?
That was my first job. I was 24. I was a child, basically, and should never have been put in charge of a score like Battlestar Galactica, but there it was.
Well, we've got to go back to that then, Bear, just to start with. I mean, how would that, I mean, who, as you say, if that's your first job,
yeah,
who said to you, this is the guy?
Well, I was working for a composer named Richard Gibbs who scored the miniseries, and I was working under him. Uh-huh. The miniseries was a 4-hour pilot, mm-hmm. basically. And so from there, when it became a series, Richard at the time was doing a lot of feature films, and also television at that time wasn't what it is today. Mm-hmm. So I think that there was a sense that, you know, he went on to do these other things, and I think that they were looking for someone else to take over to score the show. And while they were looking, they let me do one episode.
Oh, nice.
And that episode was the first episode that aired, one called 33, uh-huh. Which is, in my humble opinion, one of the best hours of television made in that decade. Yeah, yeah. It was, I mean, the miniseries was spectacular, but that first episode of season one of Battlestar really shook things up and showed that this was a series that was not going to turn into a procedural adventure of the week, that it was going to tell a gripping story that unfolded over seasons. And I didn't screw it up, you guys. I didn't screw it up. And at the end, they said, okay, why don't you come in tomorrow? Let's take a look at the next episode. And I thought, ooh, maybe I get to do two episodes.
Yeah.
Here we go. And the rest was history for me.
It just kept going. How many episodes in that first season?
There were 13, and I ended up scoring between the straight-to-DVD movies and the shows, and I did the spin-off Capricorn. I mean, I ended up scoring about 100 hours of Battlestar Galactica.
Wow.
You know, over the course of...
100 hours of music.
Almost 10.
You've not spent 100 hours doing anything, probably sitting on your ass.
I've spent a lot of hours sitting in my ass thinking about things. Mm.
Well, then you're as good at that.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? You've mastered sitting on your ass thinking about stuff.
And what would be, like, looking back on Battlestar Galactica now, what would be the kind of signature of that sound for you?
It's an interesting question, Dominic, because I feel like I'm inside my head and I don't know how to say what the signature sound is, because it's something that I feel like an outside observer was like, oh, here's this thing you do, and I'd be very interested to know. I will say that when I look back on what I did and listen, which I do once in a while, I think that it was my naivete that was on display in a really good way. I grew up loving film music. I did not grow up loving TV. I mean, I watched A-Team and Magnum P.I. and stuff, but I wasn't like thinking this is where I wanted my life direction to be. Mm-hmm. I was watching Star Wars. It was watching Conan the Barbarian and Aliens and Highlander and these kind of big epic fantasy sci-fi stories. So when I got the opportunity to do Battlestar, I was very young and I was energetic enough and eager enough that I just thought, I'm going to score this using all the techniques that I've learned studying that kind of music. I'm not going to go ask someone who has experience in TV how to do it. And I think you can hear that I didn't know what I was doing. I just know the kind of music I love to do. And in a way, I have never asked anyone how to do television. I just kind of stumbled into that way of doing it. And in a way, that kind of laid the groundwork for what I would end up being asked to do on Rings of Power 20 years later.
Mm, brilliant.
Well, as you say, I mean, you can tell that those sort of bigger movies is sort of where your influences come from. Like when I think of Battlestar, I think of it as being like an opera, and it's big and it's got big themes and it has this always underlying kind of I don't know, like the end's not going to be great, like, you know, the
foreboding.
Captain,
yes,
yeah, foreboding. There's yes. the word. The captain clicking off, you know, every time someone dies, there's another human gone, kind of thing. And that the music had that operatic, beautiful that supported that story, which was brilliant. So what a great...
Well, everyone on the show felt the same way I did, that it was something really special.
Great.
And Edward James Olmos would often pull us aside. He was very much the patriarch on set that you would assume he is. Mm. And he would always say, you guys have no idea. You guys have no idea how special this is. Talking to me and many of the cast members for whom we were all in our early 20s. Like, we didn't know, you know. But he was right. It's not always like that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys can relate to that feeling of getting involved in something early in your career, and you know, this is really special, this is really good. But then there's somebody else in your life that's like, you're going to go through the rest of your life and probably never work on something like this again. It's so rare. Mm. So that was really cool. And that operatic quality, that big sound, is something that evolved naturally. And I would just, again, in my naivete, I'd see the season one finale, and I just think, we didn't have an orchestra. It wasn't always a big sound. And I went to the studio. I very naively called my friend at the studio. I didn't even call the showrunners. And I was like, hey man, like, have you seen the season finale? I'm crying. Like, we got to get strings on this. We got to have an orchestra. And he's like, I know, we have to do it. And it's like, we found the money and just did it. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
great.
I was contractually obligated to not use orchestra, but I didn't know or care. I just saw that ending. I don't want to spoil it. The first season ending. Oh my God. And everybody on the show just knew, yeah, we gotta have an orchestra on this. Mm. And that naivete did sort of set in motion my way of approaching TV in that cinematic way, which is like, let's just look at it. And if no matter what it needs, no matter how ambitious it is, let's just go for that. You know, like that's what it should be.
Yeah.
And I think that is very much the way TV's done now. Lost also was done that way. There were some other shows around that time. But shortly before that, TV was expected to be a small, low budget experience that does not replicate the cinematic experience. Mm. And
it's almost switched now, hasn't it, TV?
It really has. Mm. It is not lost upon me, gentlemen, that after Battlestar and Walking Dead and Outlander, over the last 10 years of my career, I've made a concerted effort to move into other mediums. I felt like I had done what TV could do at the time, and I worked on Godzilla, King of the Monsters, moving into movies. I worked on little art films like The Professor and the Madman. I did video games. But that whole time, television was continuing to evolve in the way that it had started in the mid-2000s. And sure enough, when Rings of Power was announced, even then I started thinking, like, is this show going to be bigger and more grand than anything a film could even do today in the modern era? Like, are we at that tipping point? Look, bias is on the table now that I work on it. I think it is. Do you know what I mean? I think that we are at this point where it has flipped, and that television, for a variety of reasons, is telling the kind of stories that I grew up on. That's the irony of it, right? That, like, I grew up admiring all these big epic movies and not really thinking about television. But in a way, if I were a child today, the things that would really be inspiring me and I'd be obsessing over would be on TV. And that movies would be the occasional distraction, or an occasional good one would come up. Is that weird?
Well, I think it's an accurate way of describing both those mediums now, because, like, television affords you the time to spend with those characters that you just do not have in movies anymore. You know, they're in most successful movies, they're going to need to present the character and what that person is all about within the first kind of 6 to 8 minutes. Whereas in Rings of Power, you can do it over a couple of hours type thing, you know?
Reserve Bar is your online source for premium and luxury spirits, wine and champagne. And now, Reserve Bar offer same-day delivery.
Fantastic. Yeah, Reserve Bar has a vast lineup of rare and hard-to-find bottles, premium brands, celebrity spirits, and limited releases that you won't find in your local store. No one does spirits gifting better than Reserve Bar if you're looking for an elevated gift. ReserveBar.com has you covered, and you can have that gift delivered right to your door. Even better, turn that spirit's gift into a cherished memento with custom engraving. Perfect for birthdays, weddings, anniversaries, Father's Day, Mother's Day, you name it. Getting into home bartending? Fantastic. Reserve Bar has everything you need. Spirits for the shelves? Sure. But they also have every barware tool and glass you'll need.
Reserve Bar has a great feature called Cocktail Lounge.
Oh.
Now, this is a treasure trove of cocktail recipes, bartending tips, interviews with master distillers, celebrities, and more. The hot trend in spirits is ready-to-drink cocktails. Have you tried them, Dom?
I have. They're fantastic.
Delicious. They taste better than ever, and Reserve Bar now has a huge collection of them. These canned cocktails are great for parties, and if you don't have time to tend the bar, and they're ideal for tailgating season, which is already in full swing, Dom.
Is that right?
ReserveBar.com also has barware, glassware, cocktail recipes, and more. Need something for a party tonight? Reserve Bar now offers same-day delivery straight to your door. Did you forget someone's birthday gift? Well, Reserve Bar, to the rescue with same-day delivery.
Well, that's what I like about it the most. You know, if you're having an impromptu party, maybe you don't have time to go down to the supermarket, you've got enough things to do, maybe you're cooking some food, you've got guests showing up, you do the same-day delivery, everything shows up. Not only the drinks, the glassware, they'll bring ice for you, every single thing you need. Reserve Bar's got you covered.
Visit ReserveBar.com today and use promo code ONION to save $10 off your purchase of $75 or more on spirits, wine, or pre-made cocktails. But only when you use our special offer at ReserveBar.com with the code ONION. That's ReserveBar.com and code ONION. This offer expires December 31st, 2022. Dom, after years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by the big wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I first heard that Mint Mobile offers premium wireless starting at just $15 a month, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they are the first company to sell wireless online only. They cut out the cost of the retail stores and they pass all those sweet savings directly onto you.
For anyone who hates their phone bill, Mint Mobile offers premium wireless for just $15 a month. Mint Mobile gives you the best rates whether you're buying just for you or for your family. And at Mint, families start at two lines. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. Ooh, fantastic. Switch to Mint Mobile and get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month.
To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/onion. That's mintmobile.com/onion. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/onion.
I think there's also something to be said for taking risks. And when I think about all the things that I love, I mean, I guess I was going to say I love those films when I was a kid that took the risks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the copycats might be fun, but they're never as fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely think that risks in television have been greater over the last 15 years.
Okay,
creative
yeah,
risks.
Yeah.
You know, and that as a viewer is almost where you're more likely to see something that really surprises you. Uh-huh. Not exclusively, obviously.
No.
You can name 5 or 6 movies that have come out of the last few years that really took risks and were rewarded. But those are the exceptions that prove the rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas I think it used to be film, there was always something new coming out. It was almost expected that every summer some new movie would come out and blow your mind, you know?
I saw something with, I think it was Matt Damon who was talking about that and saying it's because of the way movies are released now, because it used to be you'd have your theatrical release and then the DVD release was basically the same as the theatrical.
Yeah.
So if you made if it was a movie and it cost $100 million and you got $50 million at the theater, you knew you would get $50 million and DVD, and then it's paid itself off, and then you can start making money.
And then you'd have a third one with syndication television broadcasts.
Yeah. And then like you can maybe make some profit there if it went well there and there.
Yeah.
But that whole DVD thing has disappeared now.
Absolutely.
So now no one will take the risk because you got a risky movie that costs $100 million and the $50 million you make, that's it.
You kind of have a weekend.
Mm. It's that's crazy.
It's a high stakes environment.
Mm.
And but look, I mean, that's happening in TV. I don't want to describe TV as this Shangri-La where everyone takes risks and the money doesn't matter, because everything that happened in feature film world is happening in the video game space, and it's happening in TV, where in order to stand out, you have to spend more money. The more money you spend, the greater risk you're taking.
Yeah.
I mean, and look, with Rings of Power, I think, I mean, I could talk all day about how great I think the show is, which is good,
mm-hmm.
but it also is, they are spending an amount of money that will change the history of the medium.
Yeah.
One way or the other. No, I'm not advocating one or the other. That's either going to be a one-off and no one else ever tries it, or it'll become the standard, in which case, if you aren't spending Amazon money to make your show, you're kind of doomed. And then television becomes exactly what Matt Damon was describing features were. It's a weird situation, and it's almost like the best place to be is right when a medium is exploding outward before all the money catches up. And then people get risk averse.
Because it is true, no matter what you think of Rings of Power, and I really like it. I think it's fantastic. I think what you're talking about is true. When I sit, and I seem to watch it on a Sunday, I think, and I sit there and it's a kind of, and it's an experience that I'm not getting with a lot of other TV shows where I'm in Moria. And I'm loving it. And it's huge, as we were talking about before, Dom. Mm. And these elevators going up Moria. And I'm just like, oh, wow. And then I'm on a boat that looks amazing in the middle of the sea heading for the Elven lands. And
save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver. I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's an experience that I don't feel like I've maybe got before watching a TV. I've maybe seen it in a movie theater before. And the music, and sometimes Bear was stupid enough to give me his telephone number. So sometimes I'll text him little things as I'm watching it as well. Like, oh, the theme from that.
I love your commentary, man. It's always pretty awesome.
But yeah. I, you know, there's something very special about that experience. And you know, and people can be trolls online or whatever, but that experience of sitting in your front room watching on a TV, I'm trying to think in my mind just now, I don't think I've had that before.
Mm.
What do you think, Dominic? Have you seen the show?
Yeah, I love it. It's great. I agree with Billy. I think the immersion, but also like let's say Amazon said, each week we're going to allow you to go see that at a cinema, which would be great because you'd have a phenomenal sound and a great screen to watch it on.
Yeah.
But I think most people nowadays have pretty good TVs and you can sit at home comfortable with your doggy wug, cup of tea, little snack. There's something quite cozy and intimate about that. And even though there are moments of high excitement and characters ultimately being in danger, there is a coziness about that world. You know?
I think I'm kind of working out as we're talking just now.
Yeah.
And it is a cinematic experience, but done in a way where, it's comfortable and you're in your house.
But I wonder if it's more comfortable for us specifically because we have actually been to those places and it triggers those parts of our amygdala.
Absolutely.
Wow, New Zealand and the crew and the cast and everything. You know, for us, it's quite a personal
thing. I was saying that to Dorma a couple of minutes ago, like seeing characters that kind of pop up in Lord of the Rings, in the Rings of Power, and seeing their story before that is... And even I text Bear last week, like Mithril, they've got the fucking Mithril. Yeah, I mean, things like that is just like so exciting.
It's got to be a trip for you guys.
Yeah.
I was just this morning Zooming with Megan Richards, who plays Poppy on the show, talking about the Harfoot song.
Yeah.
And I was telling her for a minute, then I was realizing like, I'm going to hang out today with the two people who have sung Hobbit songs in live action adaptations. Because I was suddenly realizing, like, I'm going to see Billy in a few hours.
Yeah.
How surreal. But then I also realized, like, how cool for her to get to pick up a tradition. I mean, can you even call it a tradition? I guess, but it's like, you know, the song in Return of the King that you sang is such an iconic thing people remember. And now here's a new Hobbit character singing a song. Like, what was that like for you to see that?
I mean, as I've told the story a few times, you know, when I wrote that song, I wanted it to sound like it's something his grandmother had sung because she heard her grandfather sing it.
Yep.
So it could have been the Harfoots. That could have came from them. Yeah. So when I heard that song, I was like, oh, it's great. The Hobbits. I'm calling them the Hobbits.
You can call them the Hobbits.
They're singing in Middle Earth. And I love that. It was great, Bear. It was so cool.
I felt the same. And I felt that it was like, I feel it as a comfort thing too. I mean, obviously the movies for me were something I experienced when they were done over and over and over, along with all the behind the scenes DVDs. The all the supplemental material that was made about what you guys went through. I mean, so I felt that same sense of coming home when I watched the show.
Yeah.
It is interesting to imagine that, I mean, I'm also trying to do my part as a filmmaker to welcome people to Middle Earth that don't feel that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's one thing that, like, I am reminded in all fan interactions, many of which, they're all intense, most are good, Some aren't. But it's still that, like, there's a whole other demographic of planet Earth, people that are younger than me, that don't feel anything about Lord of the Rings. This will be their way in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like trying to be mindful of, like, welcoming back people that loved those movies to Middle Earth, but also we're also saying to younger people, go check out those movies.
Mm. And
do you know what I mean?
And Tolkien and that universe. I know that I spoke to Pete Jackson when he was making The Hobbit, and he was saying exactly the same thing. He says a lot of people will be watching these Hobbit movies as their introduction.
Yeah.
And then they'll see Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. So now there's the Rings of Power that might be the first thing that might lead to The Hobbit, that might lead to... So
and then to the books.
Building. Well, it all goes back to the books.
Are incredible.
That's what I love about it, is that ultimately it's... All of this is based on this incredible source material. You know, I read The Hobbit when I was a kid, but it was the movies that drove me to the books. Mm-hmm. It was the movies that made me reevaluate and think... I must have missed something because I'm a very visual person. Like, film was my passion, and various animated Lord of the Rings things, they were cool. But man, for me, it was like Star Wars and Conan the Barbarian and Jurassic Park. Like,
yeah.
I am not of the generation that like Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings could compete with that. Yeah. So I just kind of wrote it off. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And then when the movies came out, I thought, I got to go back. I obviously, you know, missed something.
So did you stumble into that first Fellowship of the Ring movie thinking at that point it was kind of a successful film and your friends and family had seen it? Or what made you go
for
the first time?
No, I was preaching that this movie was going to be the greatest movie of all time before it came out. And I'll tell you why. Peter Jackson.
Right.
I had adored his films through the 90s. I rented Dead Alive, you know, that poster, the VHS box. I was like, what is this?
The scary poster.
Holy shit, that movie was amazing. Can I say holy shit?
Holy
shit, that movie is amazing. and at that same time, you know, I loved cult filmmakers. I loved Sam Raimi. I loved that kind of storytelling, and I was like, this guy Peter Jackson is a genius. Mm. And then I saw Heavenly Creatures, and then I saw The Frighteners, which is hands down the most underrated studio feature film of all time.
Mm. Yeah.
And that movie blew my mind. So then when I heard that guy is doing a big fantasy movie, that alone, I was like, oh, this is gonna be amazing. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And it was, and I felt so validated. But not surprised at all, because I just thought, you know, he and Sam Raimi were just these two guys that I was telling everybody, you got to keep an eye on these filmmakers, man. And boy, 2001 and 2002, I felt I was probably annoying all my friends between that and when Spider-Man came out. I was like, see, bro, I told you, you got to listen to me.
Yeah. Also in Rings of Power, to go back to that for a second, Howard Shore wrote the original title theme, right?
Yeah.
So did you spend some time with Howard as collaborators together?
I did and I didn't. I got to know him and speak with him a few times. We did not get to collaborate.
Right.
Because of the timing of the schedule, I started and then he did his main title 6 months later. Like, I knew it was coming, but it wasn't something that I was going to hear before I was basically done laying out all the themes and well into episode 6. But I was given free rein to do whatever I wanted. And what I wanted was to honor what he did and continue in the sort of like tradition that he set out. And so it was fantastic to hear his demo when it came in, which kind of, it was spine tingling hearing it, but also getting to talk with him. And I spoke with him several times and he was supportive and generous with his time and ultimately, it was wonderful to sort of exchange words with him about writing, about our creative process, our creative lives. That alone was amazing. But then to get to talk with him about Lord of the Rings specifically was double amazing. But then to get to talk with him about our creative process on Lord of the Rings, because I am scoring the new Lord of the Rings, is like mind-blowing amazing. So that was really cool. You know what I mean? I feel, I felt a lot of support from him and a sort of unspoken passing of the torch, like I'm doing my thing, and we're entering the second age through this lens that connects to the movies. But after that, it's like, you got this. Mm. You know what I mean?
How did it feel? Like you're then sitting there in front of a piano or something and going, okay, now, I know this is going to be like,
all right, man, I'm going to confess that, like, I talked about my naivete when I did Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
I retain it to this day.
Right.
My ability to just be naively excited about whatever I'm doing gets me through the day.
That's great.
Because can you imagine, like, if I woke up and went, okay, today I'm going to have to write a piece of music that will be as famous as Howard Shore's Shire theme and will be scrutinized by 100 million fans, I would curl up under the covers.
In the trolleyest period of history for humanity.
Oh, my God. I mean, to even sit at the computer in front of the piano, I wouldn't even get to the piano. I would just be weeping in bed.
So
I don't think of that.
So you can't think of
that. No, I get up and I go, oh, man, I get to tell this awesome story.
So, like, not even talking about everything else you've done for Rings of Power, do you write anything before you see a picture, or do you wait for them to send you some pictures, scenes?
It's a little column A and a little column B.
Uh-huh.
I watched a rough cut of two episodes. Then I read the scripts, spoke with the showrunners. Then I didn't look at footage again for almost 2 months.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I also told them I wouldn't speak to them for 2 months.
Right.
I was like, you're not going to hear anything. You're not going to hear from me. Bye-bye.
Right.
I need to go into my space where I am safe to mess around, and I'm going to write a bunch of themes. Because it's you need themes. I need themes to write anything.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, I think to write something for Lord of the Rings, you need themes.
Yeah.
And you need
so many different worlds and communities. And,
you need to have themes that connect to those different societies.
Mm-hmm.
And then within those societies, you have conflicting themes that each have to be different, but enough that you understand, oh, these are two dwarf characters that are in conflict with one another.
Yeah.
These are two elf characters. These are two human characters. And I, you know, created this whole kind of rule set and mapped out intervals and colors and rhythms, because I just so desperately wanted to make themes that stood on their own mm-hmm. and could be identified quickly. And then I looked at the footage again and started splashing some music onto some scenes.
Right.
And then I sent those scenes to the showrunners. They never heard the themes in isolation. They heard the themes in isolation when the record came out.
Okay.
Otherwise, because I put some tracks on the record. Otherwise, I just let them watch the scenes, because mm-hmm. I didn't want to ruin their ability to have the same experience you guys had. If the Casa Doom theme works, I should just be able to show you that scene and you get it.
Yeah.
And it's great. You've done such a wonderful job, Bert.
Oh, thank you. It really is.
It's wonderful.
Such an imposing world to jump into. But it's fantastic. And it's so funny, because, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen it. If you watch those incredible projects that are defined by the scores, and they take the score out, mm-hmm. you're like, what
happened there?
Like Star Wars without the score is
amazing.
Just, there's something so strange about, obviously, Jaws without the score. And the Pete Jackson Lord of the Rings film that we did without the score, I'm sure would be just like Rings of Power. There's so much that you can put into
the thing that
project.
I agree. And the thing that I learned when I transitioned from being just a fan of all these things to wanting to do all these things, because I wanted to do this when I was 5 years old. And I started writing music every day when I was 13 years old. So really, I mean, I'm 43, I've been doing this for 30 years.
Mm.
But one of the things I learned is that there, the sum total of everybody's work, director, acting, writing, editing, sound design, music, creates this thing that we, as consumers, as fans, it's very easy to worship these things. And it's fun and you want to, but they're all made by just people that step up to the plate and bring to the project what they had to bring that day.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You hear like Jerry Goldsmith's score for Chinatown, that lonely trumpet solo. He had 2 weeks to do the entire score. He got hired at the last minute. He's like, oh, shit, it's a noir. I'm just going to write the score to Chinatown. Mm-hmm. He just did it. Yeah. And then he moved on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And in a way, that's, I actually haven't even thought about verbalizing it this way before. I think in starting to realize that, I internalize that I give myself permission to write the worst music ever heard by humans. I just got to write some music today. I'm going to get out of bed and write some music. Not only am I not aspiring to be as good as Howard Shore, like I'm just aspiring to be just garbage.
Right.
If I can just sit here and just write something terrible, that gets me out of bed and gets me going. And then I start playing around with it. And you have to just get those shackles, that self-censorship. Yeah. I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, that as actors, there must be a similar thing where you must be unafraid to make a complete ass of yourself in order to find, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
There's definitely times with directors where the director will say, we got it. And we might say, can I just try something? It's probably not going to be great, but can I just try something? And very often it won't be great. Sometimes you'll catch something. But yeah, you have to be in a place of being able to make a mess.
I think it's interesting because I think we all like to be cool and people think we're cool. The life of an artist is so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Like we really have to be boldly unafraid to just look like a complete idiot.
Yeah. And that kind of safe place that you can sit in is so comfortable that you can do that sometimes. And there's nothing better as an actor, I think, than when you get a character that someone explained it once to me and I thought it was brilliant. He said, well, you burst the bubble.
Yeah.
And then you're through that sort of little cage you put yourself in, the little bubble, and then you kind of, you're just living as that character in that place. And that is the greatest. And you can see it when I was just watching the first Austin Powers movie.
Yeah.
And you can tell Mike Myers did that on that, where he just like got a character that you could say anything to him and he could riff.
Yeah.
He was there, he was in that world, and it's just the best. And it must be like that with music as well.
It's very similar. And I've been doing this long enough now, and I'm confident enough that I'm upfront when people hire me, where I say, I'm gonna try to scare you with my first ideas. Yeah. Do not fire me. But my job here is to come at you with something that is uncomfortable, pushes your buttons.
Yeah.
It's just splashing canvas.
Yeah.
We'll try a bunch of different things. But if I come out of the gate right away with something that's safe and conservative and what is to be expected of the genre, then we're dooming ourselves to something that's ordinary.
Yeah.
And you can always tell when someone goes like, oh yeah, do that. Or sometimes they're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? And the Rings of Power team, they were all great.
That's great.
They were all fantastic. And even as I... even as I described some of my ideas, the Numenor theme in particular is outside of the palette of Howard Shore. I perhaps foolishly expressed my enthusiasm for bringing in Middle Eastern instruments so that it felt Egyptian and Babylonian and Mesopotamian, maybe some ancient Greece. And then I realized too late that it's like, uh-oh, I am scaring people. And one of the showrunners said, I don't know. And I said, I understand this is scary and I want you to trust me that if I write this and you don't like it, it's not going in your show. Fear not.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to let me do it. Mm. And he was like, okay.
Yeah. You got to be able to do those big swings, you know?
Yeah.
I think what makes TV and film even harder, I think, for musicians is they put these temps on, don't they? Temp music.
Yep.
And then the director, the showrunner, whatever, gets used to hearing the temp music.
And temp music, just for anybody that doesn't know what it is like scores or songs from other sources that are placed temporarily into the edit just to see if the edit works and to be able to screen it for people.
Yeah.
But it can create a groove in your mind.
Mm. I've seen it a lot with directors.
Yeah.
Where they're just like, just do something like the temp. It's like it's Braveheart or something.
Yeah, it is a reality of how film and television are made. And sometimes, you know, aspiring composers will come up to me and that'll be a question. What do you do when a director is like, that's all they want is this, you know, please. They're like imploring me, what are your secrets? And I always say the same thing. Well, you give them the temp and hope that your next job is better. Mm. I learned a trick from my mentor, who was one of the great legends of film music, Elmer Bernstein.
Oh.
He scored The Ten Commandments, The Great Escape, The Magnificent Seven, To Kill a Mockingbird, Ghostbusters,
nice.
Animal House, Age of Innocence, Cape Fear with Martin Scorsese. He had a long career.
Wow.
And he taught me when I was young, there's only one question you ever need to ask a filmmaker. And I use this almost every day to this day. As he says, never let them talk about music. Don't ever talk to them about music in any situation. He says, all you need to ask them is, what do you want the audience to feel?
Mm-hmm.
That question bypasses all of the things that are in the way of the core truth. Any director, whether they are brilliant or completely amateur, has an answer for that question.
Mm, yeah.
At any frame of their footage.
Yeah. They can tell that's what the director's language is,
that's,
right?
That's literally it. They are the avatar and the advocate for the audience. At any time, they can say that. And when you bypass all the other linguistic road bumps about music and just say, what do you want the audience to feel?
Yeah.
The truth comes out. And then you can go, I got you.
Yeah, you can speak the same language at that point, right?
I'm a translator.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, my job is to talk film with a filmmaker and then go, like, turn it into music and send it back and say, did I translate this correctly?
Mm.
You know?
So what for you are the kind of standout scores in movie history? What are the ones that you always come back to that are the masterpieces?
I mean, I mentioned one already. I think Elmer Bernstein's To Kill a Mockingbird is so timeless. It was written at a time when film music before the 50s was Western classical music. I love King Kong and all these other, you know, all these like Max Steiner scores and yet it all sounded like bombastic classical Western music.
Mm.
And even to a degree, like, should King Kong sound like bombastic Western orchestral music? I don't know. That was the norm. In the 50s, that started to change. There are so many great film scores, but I mean, I guess, are you asking which ones are my personal faves?
Yeah, personal is always the best because there's ones across the board that everyone will agree of. Like obviously, Jaws is a standout one for most people.
Yeah.
But as someone who actually works in the business, what are the ones that continue to move you?
You know, the ones that Conan the Barbarian by Basil Poledouris is just a masterclass in epic writing and doesn't ever get enough praise, you know, for how amazing it is. I mean, there's so many, like Jerry Goldsmith's Star Trek, The Motion Picture is another one that gets sort of lost in the main title that became Star Trek, The Next Generation. It just sort of feels like, oh, that's Star Trek. It's no, at the time, that was this weird Robert Wise movie that got greenlit because of Star Wars, but it's nothing like Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the themes in it are so just crushingly gorgeous. They have no right to be that gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Since, you know, I mean, Ennio Morricone, my God, Cinema Paradiso.
Oh,
and The Mission. Yeah. I mean, his work in the 80s, that was Ennio kind of like, he had done like 200 spaghetti westerns. And I mean, he was still at his peak, just like writing loop-de-loops around everybody else. The Untouchables is another one. But you know what I mean? That like when you say Ennio Morricone, people think, wah, wah, wah. And to be fair,
that's amazing.
If he only wrote that,
yeah.
he's in the Film Score Hall of Fame forever.
But the Mission is one of the real.
The Mission, my God. And it's like, the movie's not even that great.
It's
good, but that score, my God, the way he took he took these South American children's choir and the oboe that the Jeremy Irons character played, right? It was like the oboe soars over this melody with the South American, like, indigenous percussion. It's just like a masterclass
in
how
brilliant.
To do that. You know,
we had Jaquino on. I'm sure you know Jaquino, right?
Of course, yeah.
I was lucky enough to work with him on Lost, and so we had him on, and we were asking him about how he came up with that kind of iconic theme now from Up, from Pixar's Up, and he said that he was just humming it in the shower one day, remember?
Yeah.
He woke up with it, and then he was like, I'm not sure what that is, where it's come from. Let's see if it hangs around. And then he said he got in the shower and it was still hanging around. And then he thought, I'm going to have to find out if that is someone else's. And then realized that it wasn't someone else's. And then became this, what, one of the more standout kind of melodies from Pixar canon.
Oh, today. Yeah, absolutely. And I love knowing he has that same, he must have that same insecurity I have, which is when you get a great idea, you're like, well, this has got to be somebody else's.
Right.
There's no way I thought of this.
There's only so many notes, isn't there? So you've got to think, well, someone through time must have thought of putting these six together.
I know.
Yeah. Well, that's like McCartney with Yesterday, right? I mean, he was walking around for months singing this song called Scrambled Eggs that he thought, well, this can't be an original. This must be someone else's. And then sooner or later, everyone was like, no, we've never heard that before. And then it became Yesterday, so... Wild.
Amazing.
I think if we can jump back to another one of my favorites of yours, and one that, you know, for me could have went really wrong, is Outlander.
Because talk to me as a Scot about how wrong that could have gone.
But surely you must be a bit of a Scot yourself. McCreary.
I am indeed.
Bear McCreary.
The McCreary side of the family.
Where is your family from?
I think they go back to Ireland,
right.
But the McCrearys have been in America since the 1880s in the American South. And the other side of my family is Armenian. And actually, my Battlestar days, I wrote for Armenian Duduk. The Kalpakian side of my family escaped the genocide and came through Ellis Island in the 20s.
Right.
The Armenian Duduk and... the bagpipes were both appear early on in Battlestar Galactica season one as my little DNA thumbprint.
I love it.
But I grew up loving Celtic music, and I always went to the Highland Games. There was a Highland Games near Bellingham, Washington, where I grew up, and I would just go there and I would hear there'd be like 40 bagpipe bands in competition. So the drone, it's like, you know, acres and acres of bagpipe bands all droning on that B flat. And you're just like, I would go to bed at night with the drone stuck in my head. And I even in the morning, I'd wake up and I don't have perfect pitch, but I go, is that B flat still in my head to go down the piano? There it is.
Oh,
do you know
really?
What I mean? Because you hear it for so long. Where that might drive someone else insane, I'm in my happy place, man. Watching people doing the folk dances and the caber toss. So that part of my DNA has always been something that has sparked my musical interest. And that, I think, was a reason that Ron Moore hired me on Outlander.
Right.
But I was nervous about how the show would be perceived by Scottish people. I mean, it's written by a woman from Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I completely understand any skepticism about Americans telling this story. What did you think of it?
Well, for me,
you were on it, needless to say, what was your first impression?
Well, I kind of always worry when people take Scottish sort of culture, and especially when it's sort of historical and, oh, this is just going to go down that sort of shortbread tin sort of, you know, fancy little kilts.
Do you remember, did you see the old... Disney movie, Rob Roy, the Highland Rogue.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And then Darby O'Gill in The Little People, Sean Connery's first movie.
That's right.
These like old depictions of like, I remember I dug up the Rob Roy movie after I saw the Liam Neeson one, which I thought was fucking awesome, if I may say that.
Yeah.
But it was like Rob Roy's like, unhand her, ye knave. Like you realize like, And I, you know, the Grieger, the artist I work with sometimes on Scotland, on things in Outlander, he sings the main title. You know, I've learned a lot from him just about, I think he bristles at that.
Yeah.
In a way that as an American, I started to intuit like, that's kind of a shitty depiction.
Yeah.
But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, is that something that you always felt was unfair?
Yeah, there is a sort of, it's when it becomes too simplified, doesn't it, and too sort of cleaned up. Like the music, a lot, even back when I was growing up, there was a show called Thingamajig.
Yeah.
And they'd play these kind of Scottish and everybody sang a hold the hand, oh, hand, oh, hand, oh. And it was just, it used to grate because, you know, we'd have parties at home where people would sing real Gaelic and real Celtic songs, and it was magic. It was real, and it was about real things and Robert Burns, and it was brilliant. And I was so glad when I heard your music from the show that you got that, you know. You
That's
got,
100%.
You got Scotland by the balls.
100% you know? What I was going for.
You know what I mean, though? Yeah. Where it was real people singing about real things and real relationships.
But I do want to thank you for getting the music right.
Oh, man, that means the world. That means the world. And I love
McCreary.
That's right. I was wondering if people in Scotland would be like, Ben McCreary.
You know? Great name. He must be one of us.
It's such a great name. Yeah, well, while we continue to talk about music, should we eat the world?
Oh, we should. We always eat the world. Delicious. Because we do like to eat. We're hobbits, after all.
Billy and Dom eat the world.
Did you bring this in, Bear? Or did you suggest
You guys
this?
Are going to surprise me.
Okay, so we're going to be eating a lovely treat from Israel.
Oh, lovely. And is this then afternoon tea? Or is this dinner?
This would be afternoon tea.
This is afternoon tea time.
Yes.
Here comes Eddie.
Here comes Eddie and all eyes are on him.
I'll read a little blurb here while Eddie's
So tell me, what? Thank you.
What we're going to be trying here.
Thank you very much.
Bear. Oh, thanks, Eddie. It's called the Bamba Peanut Butter Snack. Bamba is a snack made of peanut butter flavored puffed maize, manufactured in Israel. Bamba is one of the leading snack foods produced and sold in Israel. Thanks, Eddie.
Oh.
It's been marketed since 1964 with no decline in sales, it says. This
Fantastic.
Might have come directly from Bamba. Bamba makes up for 25% of the Israel snack market. Similar products from other domestic manufacturers include the butterfly, the shush. It's also named the Bamba snack because it sounds like baby talk. What sounds like baby talk?
Bamba.
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 It's made from peanut butter flavored puff maize, contains no preservatives or food coloring, and is enriched with several vitamins, but it does contain high amounts of
what was
fat
the, wait, what was the first
salt.
Thing? Peanut butter flavored?
Puffed maize.
Puffed maize, I guess.
The energy content is 160 calories per 28 grams, which is a lot because these weigh light as air. Bamba is certified kosher by the Badatz Jerusalem. The Washington Post described it as cheese doodles without the cheese. William, should we give it a go? So this is very popular in Israel. If there's anyone out there in Israel listening or watching to us, hello.
Sometimes the listeners will send us these ideas.
Really?
So this is from a listener.
Fantastic.
Let's have a go.
I've had these type of things before. I don't know if it was strictly Bamba, but lovely.
That's fascinating because the texture makes me think I'm eating a cheese puff.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never tasted...
Or a Watsit, as we would call it in the UK.
But it's peanut buttery. It's overwhelmingly peanut buttery.
Extremely.
I don't normally like peanut butter unless it's actually peanut butter. I don't like things.
You don't like peanut butter flavored things?
No.
Let's explore this.
Do you not like a Reese's peanut butter cup?
No.
Oh, I do.
I just like peanut butter.
How about Reese's Pieces?
Nope.
Yeah.
I like them too. Do you know most people in England think that, you know, because Reese's Pieces are obviously put down for E.T. to walk into the house. Most people in Britain think that they're M&Ms. Because we don't have Reese's Pieces. Or we didn't.
Really?
We didn't in the 80s. We might now.
Fascinating.
These are lovely, if you don't mind me saying. Does anyone mind me saying that?
I don't mind you saying.
One day when I travel to Israel, I will be on the lookout.
For the Bamba.
The Bamba snack.
I'm going to continue here, guys. In the advertising for the Bamba, it says, Bamba's advertising features the baby Bamba character heavily. Baby Bamba. Bamba is a cartoon character depicted wearing a blue diaper or nappy. He has one tooth and he's bald, except for one ginger curl at the front of his head. In honor of International Women's Day 2020, a female baby Bamba was introduced. The female baby Bamba wears a pink t-shirt and has pigtails. In March 2021, the baseball team, the New York Nets, announced its partnership with this particular crisp. Wow, you go, New York Mets.
I tell you what, Dom, it won't be long till I'm looking like the baby Bamba and you'll need to look after me.
I'd love that. Well, just one tooth, no hair.
One tooth, no hair.
I don't know how you're going to grow a ginger hair, but you'll work on it.
I don't know, I'm Scottish.
Every so often, Billy will grow just one single hair out of the tip of his nose.
Just like that.
Wow.
It gets quite long as well.
Wow.
And Dom will always tell me, no, Dom tells me to pluck it.
It's amazing. So it's amazing. It will get long.
For anyone who's just listening, Bear McCreary has wonderful long hair.
Mm. That's true.
Have you always had that?
I started to grow it out about 20 years ago, and I've kept it at shoulder length until about 2015, when I just decided to never cut it again.
Wow.
Which is funny because, you know, so many people grew their hair out in the pandemic, but I had already done it. And then when I was at the at the Rings of Power premiere. Only then, I feel so dumb confessing this, only then did I realize everyone wears wigs in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone. They have these incredible hair pieces. Even, you know, actors, I'm staring at their face 8 hours a day for a year. And then I'm looking around, suddenly looking like, I look like I'm cosplaying as, you know what I mean?
As
like
a dwarf.
I know, exactly. Like, it's like, who's this fanboy over here that, hey, Aragorn, you know?
These are fantastic.
Yeah, I'm digging these.
Now, guys, you might be thinking out there, the shape, the consistency, the lightness. How is this thing manufactured?
Well, Billy, could you tell me?
Shall I tell you?
Yeah.
Corn grits are popped under high pressure, turning them into long white lines of puffed, unflavored bamba. The lines are then cut into nuggets and then moved to a drying chamber where they are air baked.
This is so appetizing.
For just 20 seconds.
20 seconds is plenty, dog.
Which gives them that lovely crispy texture.
Is it, though?
Yeah, it's plenty
are
for
you
a
sure?
puff. Yeah.
The peanut butter, imported from Argentina, mm-hmm. is added at the end. A worker stands on a step above a rotating drum and pours a pitcher of liquid peanut butter into each container.
What's his name? Him or her?
It's called Juan.
Right, carry on.
As the drums turn, the nuggets are coated. The hot bamba is then moved along a conveyor belt to cool before packaging. Not after packaging, because it could damage the packet.
Of course, of course.
Or stick to the sides.
Brilliant.
That's a little bit of information about the manufacturer.
Yeah. Let's score them. Flavor out of 10. We score out of 10 here.
You can add a decimal point if you'd like.
It could be 6.4. It could be 8.9. But the flavor has to be out of 10. And while you're thinking about that, Bear,
mm-hmm.
how many hours have you written of music for The Rings of Power?
I wrote 9 hours of music for 8 hours of footage.
Wow.
Where's the other hour?
It's the themes.
All right. There we go.
Yeah.
9 hours of music.
And I did that in 9 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
an hour. That's an hour a month.
It's an hour a month. How much is that a day, Dom?
No.
Look at the math. Look at his math mind trying to work that out.
How can you work that out?
Well, see, let's say 30 days in a month.
Yeah, let's say 30.
It's about 60. 60 minutes.
About 2 minutes a day.
60 minutes in an hour.
2 minutes a day.
2 minutes.
Half
doable.
A song. Is it though?
I don't know. I'm not a musician.
Have you ever?
It is doable in that it was done.
It was done.
It takes longer than you would think, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
When I did that song for The Hobbit, you know, the last goodbye, I went down to New Zealand. I was supposed to be there for like a week. I was there for about 2 months.
Yeah,
sending things back and forth.
They couldn't get him out.
No, I couldn't. I got a hotel room for free. It was lovely.
Amazing.
But I was just thinking there that, you know, themes and the worlds, and you're talking about Howard Shore. I remember when I first sent that song to Howard Shore, I was shitting it.
Mm.
You know, that he would just say, this is awful.
That is rubbish.
And he wrote back and said he loved it. He says, but there's no minor seventh chords in Lord of the Rings. And I was like, I didn't even know I was playing a minor. There was a capo on the guitar.
I had no idea. You put a minor, hold on.
I can't believe
Before
you,
I agreed
Billy.
To this interview, I didn't realize you put a minor
I'm sorry,
seventh chord.
Bear. I'm sorry.
Why was no one telling me this? Bear, this is outrageous.
If you want to leave,
we have to cut right now.
No, you can just
oh
leave.
Oh my God.
That's fine.
Billy,
minor
what's that
seven?
So full?
What the fuck is wrong with you?
I don't know, Bear.
And I bet
Dom.
It wasn't just one. I bet it was over and over again.
I didn't even know there was one in it.
You're a disgrace,
man.
Disgraceful. Utterly
oh,
disgusting.
Oh God, let's change the subject. He's left us like a stink in the air now. All right, scores out of 10. I'm going to score
God,
it.
Dom.
I like this taste, but I would give it a slight critique here,
ooh.
Which is that I want a little bit of salt. I like the peanut butter. I want a little bit of salt in my peanut butter. So I'm going to demote it by a point and I'm going to give it a 7. Would have given it an 8 with more salt.
I used to go up your house, Dom, and you'd have a jar of peanut butter mm-hmm. with chilies in it.
Yeah, I made it myself.
And then you'd just eat it by the spoonful.
I would dig out the peanut butter into a bowl, molten salt, cayenne pepper, paprika, chili flakes, garam masala,
sounds
black
awesome.
Pepper, coconut oil, mix it all up, put it back in the jar. I lived on that.
But you also did this because your friend only likes peanut butter in butter form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's very thoughtful of you.
Yeah, yeah, I'm here for Billy.
I'd now like to change that, Bear, because I love these things.
Yeah, they're tasty, these.
Wow, this is changing your worldview on peanut butter.
What was the score then?
Flavor, 9.2.
Yeah, I love it. You'd like to take that bag home tonight, wouldn't
you? Well, it's almost empty. Mm-hmm. Bear's going through it like there's no end.
My second round, man.
What about you, Bear? Scores out of 10.
I'm going to give it an 8. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm going to give it an 8 is that almost like you were saying, Dom, I'm so used to peanut butter being in combination with other things. Mm-hmm. I wish I had some chocolate to wrap this around. Like, can you imagine like a malt ball? Mm-hmm. Like if there was like chocolate covering on this peanut butter light fluffy thing?
Mm-hmm. You could invent that.
So it's almost, is it fair to demote a good flavor because of what else you wish was there?
Yeah, no, I think you can.
All right, the next category. Aesthetics.
How does it look?
How does it look?
What do you think of the
look?
It looks
a little bit like a grub, like a beetle larva, like a fat maggot.
Somebody would eat in one of those like Survivor shows.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or like packing styrofoam?
Packing styrofoam for sure.
This is all quite negative.
The end of a cigarette.
Right.
What if someone loves all those things? Mm-hmm. We aren't saying they're negative.
Okay. I'm putting negative connotations.
Yeah, you're putting vibes out.
I feel bad about that now.
It's not the most attractive chip I've ever seen, but I like the strangeness of it. I'm going to give it a 5.
I was going to say 5.
Okay.
I was going to say 6.
Oh.
Ever the optimist.
Yeah.
Now, Billy, your favorite category?
The final category is usefulness. How useful is this food?
How useful is this
exactly, food? Exactly, Bear, yeah. It's a brain
Let me say, for instance, you had friends coming over. They weren't invited. Mm. They just came through your house and you said, oh, are you guys hungry? And they went, yeah, we are hungry. And you went to your cupboard and wait till you hear what's in it.
Yeah, what have you got this week?
There's 2 pounds of flour. Mm-hmm. There's 2 packets of these. There's a couple of eggs in the fridge. Some cream. 2 pints of milk. And some hundreds and thousands toppings.
It's a lot of dairy produce you have.
But that's all you've got in the house?
Mm.
Is this useful? Could you do something? Could you make? Could you do?
Or the eggs, I'm wondering if there's a way to powder these into some sort of
an omelet
with an
With some scrambled eggs. So you sprinkle this on it. I don't know. Yeah. Are they useful?
I don't know. I can't think. I mean, it's going to crumble into a powder, but then what do you do with that powder? Could you crumble that onto popcorn or something?
That's a bad idea. That's a nice idea.
Maybe.
I didn't see you had popcorn.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I do it at my house.
All right, fair enough.
That's the only thing that I can... Because it's a savoury thing. It's not going to really go sweet, is it?
No, well...
Could you put it on a cake, maybe? On a chocolate cake?
On ice cream? Could you crumble it on the ice cream?
That's a tough one.
Could you actually use it as packing peanuts?
Could you if you're saying
you have a Fabergé egg or something really valuable, put it in a box, you realize you don't have any... You've got to ship it out right away.
Mm. I'll let you hear what happened with that, Brian. I'm the FedEx man. See, it just...
So as shipping peanuts, you're saying it's quite useless.
It's not very
good. It fails
good for
in this category.
Your egg would be cracked.
Yeah. Okay.
But I've now made the powder so you can see what it's like.
Yeah. Versatile. You got it all over your
You know what
now.
Else I'm thinking?
Mm.
Hearing that on a close mic?
Yeah.
ASMR? You know, like.
People like that, don't they?
Oh, sounds like you're eating a raw carrot.
That's Bear McCreary eating.
Eating.
Really?
What's this called again?
A bamba.
Bear McCreary eats a bamba.
Just enjoy this, ladies and gentlemen.
Nice that.
There's a market for that.
Yeah, it's nice that.
Do that for 10 hours?
People love that. Although our listeners don't, we had a vote and they hate it when we eat too close to the mic, so I would say
55% of them hated it.
That's a slim majority.
45 are okay with it. I'm going to say in terms of in terms of versatility,
yeah,
how useful it is, I'm going to give it a 2.5.
2.5, that's not very good. I'm feeling very optimistic today, Bear. You know, it's nice having you in the studio.
You've got
and
it all over
about
you.
Music. Yeah. No, I don't give a shit. I love it. In fact, I want to play the baby in the ads.
And yeah, we'll get in
touch. You could write the music for it, please.
I'll write a new jingle.
Yeah. And, what's it called?
Bamba.
Bamba. And you, it's could got no GMOs.
You could be the Baby Bamba.
I'm the Baby Bamba. We'll write Billy that
Boyd,
later.
Billy Boyd, the Baby Bamba.
Billy Boyd, the Baby Bamba.
That's a lot right of there. Alliteration there.
That's fantastic. I'm going to give it 6. I think I could find something. Yeah, I could find something to do with it.
You're the good cop in this scenario, I see.
Bear, what do you think while I'm rubbing my breasts?
Don't vote on that. Vote on the snap.
Yeah. Yeah. No comment on that.
Right.
Although maybe as like a massage tool, like you could crumple it up and try it and like,
oh yeah,
as an exfoliant. That's
exfoliant,
what it is.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm changing mine to 7.5.
Wow. There you go.
What do you think, Bear?
I think it could work. Massage it into the muscles.
Give it a score out of 10 then.
For me?
Usefulness.
Well, I wanted to ship my Fabergé egg and I can't, so it's 0.
So it's an absolute 0.
That's not good. It's damning.
Yeah, it's damning. It can only do one thing.
Although I guess in your hypothetical with the guests that came over, I would do a little omelet and use it as garnish, I guess.
Yeah. But it's still a 0.
2, I mean.
A peanut butter omelet? Has
a
that ever happened before?
5, I don't know. But you did also say these are people that I wasn't expecting or didn't even want to come over. If I don't want them to come over, I probably want them to leave.
Yeah.
And wait a minute.
So then it's...
Then it's a 10.
It's perfect.
Because then you bring it out, I would cover the omelet with this. Yeah.
Would you like a peanut butter omelet?
Yeah.
We'll see you next week.
This was an absolute treat.
A peanut butter dust omelet.
Yeah. I tell you what, Bear, we could talk all day with you. It's great.
Well, should we finish with a song?
No, can I ask one question?
Well,
all right,
I'll allow
it. Because there's something that we always like to do because, you know, in case a listener, maybe a young listener, is maybe thinking about becoming a composer or doing film music or TV music, how did you get from a 13-year-old in your room writing music every day to being the guy that did Battlestar Galactica? What happened in there that made that possible?
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Thanks,
That is a good question. I love what I do.
Yep.
And I started doing it all day, every day. And I, when I was about 13, realized that I just wanted to do it all the time. Uh-huh. And I would be okay if I lived under a bridge, if it meant I got to write music. And when I got to college, I just found people that were doing student films. Anybody that had anything that needed music, I was thrilled to do it.
Great.
And I built up a group of people that felt the same way. We had no money. You know, I would scrounge together enough money to get pizza for the orchestra session. So I would, you know, conduct my score. And also I would write for whoever was available. I called every musician I knew. And so if I was doing a student film, I'd go, okay, we got 3 clarinets, a snare drum, and a cello. So that's what you're going to get. You know what I mean?
Great.
And I just kept doing that. And there was a point early on Battlestar in the first season that I realized that nothing had changed, but I was finally getting paid a little bit, just a little bit. And that I was still just waking up every day doing what I love to do. And I think that then my actual, like, no joke advice is, if you love what you do and that's why you are collaborating with people, people want to work with you. You want to be that type of person that's excited and comes into the room eager to contribute and just mm-hmm. excited to get to do your part of it. And if you are you don't even have to be talented. The only thing you have to do is work hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? The people mm-hmm. that put in the work, I don't think I'm supremely talented. I think I put in a lot of hours.
Good.
Let me put it this way. My talent could definitely be my work ethic, you know, that I just put in the hours and I love doing it. And I feel like that benefited me so much. And I still like to think that I walk into any project like, wow, this is cool. Let's do this, you guys.
Oh,
you know what I mean? And
yeah.
And sometimes I'm going to make money. Sometimes I won't. I'm just here to like have fun doing what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't get to do that, I'll go toward someone who will let me do that.
Well, it's been fantastic having you on. I think, if we've got a musician with us, don't you think we should end with a song?
Let's
so we sometimes, well, we often ask our guests, and sometimes they say no, to suggest a song that they think is funky. Now, just so everyone out there knows, doesn't mean need to be funky in terms of like, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire funky or Bobby Womack funky.
Sure.
Does it move you?
Yes.
You know, Mozart can be funky.
Yeah.
You know,
is it funky?
Strauss can
you?
Be funky. Did it get you going? Did you feel something?
Did you get your juices going listening to this?
Do you want to introduce this song to us and to our listeners?
Yeah. So Billy texted me about this, and I thought, like, this definition of funky means that when you hear it, you have to stop what you're doing, and the music just grabs hold of your body, and you go to another place, and it takes you there.
Love it.
That's what good music does for me, and there's so many pieces of music. And it's actually one we've already alluded to in our conversation. The piece that I thought of was from Jerry Goldsmith's score to Star Trek The Motion Picture, Elia's theme, which is so beautiful. It's so, it has no reason to be so beautiful. And it's like Jerry Goldsmith is just like writing circles around what that character needs, but he's giving her all this depth. And it's not even a theme that would sort of go on into, I'm sorry, am I getting too into Star Trek?
No, no, come on.
You can never get too into Star Trek.
Billy, you sure? Don't mess with me, bro.
Honestly.
Okay.
Look at the Star Trek poster up there.
There you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, to me, this is one of those like deep sort of...
Space Nine.
Indeed. Yeah. Space Nine. It's not something that became part of the popular lexicon of Star Trek, the way the main title did from that movie that became this theme for TNG. Mm-hmm. It's like this, it's almost like buried at the bottom of Star Trek lore in between the original series and The Wrath of Khan, when the only thing else was this weird movie that is good or not, I don't know, but that score is good. Mm-hmm. And even buried in that score is that theme that is just crushingly gorgeous, and when it comes on, if it comes on my Spotify or I'm walking on earbuds or whatever I'm doing, I have to stop what I'm doing and like just experience it.
Very cool. Well, Eddie, have you got that? Have you got Ilya's theme?
Yes, sir.
Jerry Goldsmith.
Let's hear it. Let's have a listen.
Celli, start with the tune. Little quote of the theme. But back to the good stuff. Listen to the counter line. Moving up and down like a wave.
So did that end up becoming the theme tune to The Next Generation?
No.
It
only exists in the movie.
So how does it? But it does.
There's
link
a character
to the
named Elia who is in that movie. Why am I? You tell us, Billy. You.
Well,
there
was another. There's another theme in it, which was the main theme that then became.
You actually heard the horns. Da 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 da.
That becomes The Next Generation.
Yes,
that's from this movie.
Right.
It was one of several themes that Goldsmith wrote. But it's that other one, Elia's theme, that's so gorgeous. It's like my body tenses up because I can't even handle how beautiful it is.
Isn't music weird like that?
It's incredible, isn't it?
Because there's basically four notes there.
Yeah.
And it's just, as you say, the counter melodies there.
Yeah, and just the way that it's, the upper strings are floating up and down. Da 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 da. And then the celli that are normally down low are taking the melody. It's so beautiful. And then
very
it just
pretty.
Builds and builds, and it's just like just jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's a sympathetic character in that movie.
Yes, but this is where we can talk Trek. I think the movie itself is controversial. Some people love it. Some people hate it. I love it as a historical oddity that you just have to remember that there was no Wrath of Khan and TNG. It was just the show that had arguably failed.
It's done.
A cartoon that had failed and this weird movie that kind of failed, but they were all spectacular in their own way. Mm-hmm. And Goldsmith, this is where, honestly, I think he saw Star Wars come out and was like, bro, I can do that. Because it's like, did... You're obviously looking at me going, this character must be one of the most immortal characters in film. Yeah. Like in Dr. Zhivago. No, no. She's like a weird alien that turns into a robot and turns into a robot that has vaginal connotations. Like it's so weird. It's so weird. Sorry, it's a weird. There's like alien anuses and all kinds of weird shit in this one. It's true though.
No, I feel like I'm going to watch this film.
I mean, Spock has to go through the orifice that is like, it's very sexual and super weird. God. But what I'm saying is Goldsmith went, Star Wars had just come out and he was like, I can do that.
I'll do that.
Exactly. So he wrote a soaring epic theme and then this love theme that like, man, only he could have written. Or is it a love theme? I don't know. It's just this thing that floats above the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why, for me, it is a piece of music outside of the context of the film. Mm-hmm. But that's the absurdity of it, right? Mm-hmm. That it's like Jerry Goldsmith wrote something that the movie didn't need. You could argue, like, didn't even make sense in the context of the movie. Like, it's so emotional. Mm-hmm. But he was a workaholic and, I believe, a genius. And he's the kind of guy that could... He didn't save it for something else. He's like, I'm going to put that melody there.
Yeah.
And then the next thing that comes along, you know, the next movie he did was like Alien, probably. I'm going to do that.
I'll do another one.
I'll do another one. And Elmer Bernstein was his generation. He was like that too. He would sit at the piano and when I was organizing scores in his studio, and he would just kind of sit down and like mess around when he had 5 minutes. And then I'd look at him and I'd go, Elmer, what score was that? And he's like, I don't know. I'm just messing around. It's nothing. And you realize these guys that condition themselves and train themselves, you know, to just output what we would say is genius work, which goes back to what I was saying earlier about as a consumer, you worship it. It becomes a deity. Like, oh my God, that's so genius. Is it genius or is it just at that point in his life what Jerry Goldsmith could do on Tuesday?
Mm, yeah.
That's what it actually was. Yeah. Even though for me, it's like, that's genius. If I write a piece of music half as good as Ilya's theme before I die, I'll go, man, I made it. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there you go. That's funky.
It is definitely funky. We like to rate these funky things based on a funk level, don't we? Like a funk meter.
Yeah, funk meter.
Funkometer.
So what would the meter... How would we...
Well, the lower level of funk is Brahms, who is not generally seen as being classically funky.
Okay. And what would the top level be?
All the way up to the top, which is Prince at his most purple.
Yep.
Okay.
So if you could think of an artist that sits somewhere in that category, I'm going to go first. I'm going to say David Bowie as Aladdin Sane.
Well, that's quite
it's pretty funky.
Yeah.
It's pretty funky.
What if I said Leonard Nimoy singing Bilbo's theme?
Oh, that's funky.
Is that quite funky?
Yeah, it's funky.
Do you want to mark it in any way?
Yeah. I mean, like in terms of funk level, I mean, I think it's somewhere sitting around... boy, the Bilbo Baggins song is good.
It's a good one.
It's made you think of it, hasn't it?
Funny because I'm also thinking, like, now my brain is going down that path. Where there's a whip, there's a way.
Well, what was that?
Which, by the way, legit is funky.
Mm. I know.
Where there's a whip, there's a way.
And they had dancers in there. And
yeah, that's like...
You could have that. That could be your level of funk.
Yeah, you could join me with that. I'm happy to have.
If I can get to the end of Rings of Power and find a place to quote both the Bilbo Baggins song and Where There's a Whip and There's a Way, but in like a big orchestral setting, you know, just gorgeous and French horns and strings. It just have people go, that melody.
What? Yeah, was that?
I want to do it. I don't know if it'll happen.
Well, we'll watch this space, Bear.
Yeah. Let's make it happen.
Well, the music you are doing in it is just beautiful, Bear. It really is.
You.
And it's even better now that I've met you and now you have as well.
But yeah, it's always nice to put
it. You enjoy it more, don't you?
Yeah.
And the more music. I speak to you as well and find out where you kind of came from with your music and then you hear it in the music, it makes it even better.
I appreciate you saying that. It's wonderful. I feel like music is so incredibly personal. Mm. As much as one thinks that you can write in somebody else's style, like you can't. Like I can only write what I am, and I am what I am today. Mm. And if I wrote something today, it might be different than what I write tomorrow.
Well, the music you have written and the world you've created and God of War and Battlestar and Outlander and Rings of Power now, I would implore everyone to go and listen to that stuff.
Well,
and,
indeed.
Yeah. I appreciate that, gents. And thanks for everything you guys have done to create things that inspired me as I was on my path to do what I do. I mean, I feel like that's the great thing about art is that you get to, everybody gives to everybody else.
Yeah,
and everybody
true.
Inspires everybody else.
Well, it's been great having you on, Bear. Billy, we've run out of time.
Yeah, we've run out of time. So tell people where they can send voice messages.
Well, yeah, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you could do that wherever you subscribe and rate and review your podcast. And you can also get in touch with us on our YouTube page, which is the Friendship Onion.
Friendship Onion.
Just on YouTube.
And you can send messages on speakpipe.com/Friendship Onion. And
or you can get merch at thefriendshiponionpodcast.com. I think that's it, right?
And then go and listen to Bear McCreary music. Why wouldn't you? Watch the shows that he's done.
Watch the Rings of Power. And we'll see you guys next week
on the Friendship Onion.
Yay!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.